Hello, welcome to the Metro West Daily News Podcast, part of the Wicked Local Network. I'm Megan Kelly, I'm digital editor of the Metro West Daily News, and I'm here with Brad Avery.
Hello.
And Bill Shaner.
That's me.
And we know it's been a couple weeks since we had a podcast, but schedules,
We're not dead yet.
Not dead yet.
We're still doing it.
Life got in the way a little bit, but here we are. It is Monday, November 7th. It is a day before the election. We are all tired and stressed and thought we would put together this podcast as kind of a voter's guide for Massachusetts for tomorrow. So we'll do a rundown of what the local races are to watch and what you're going to see on your ballot. And then we will be back on Wednesday to discuss what we've learned, what has happened, and all of that, hopefully.
It's crazy to think that this is all going to be over on Wednesday.
Well, yeah. Let's not.
Well, sort of.
I know you young folk don't remember the election of 2000, but that was not settled the day before. Settled the day after. So.
Right.
I just hope it is over. I hope there's a clear answer and that no matter what happens afterwards, whoever tries to, you know, sue or just, you know, not concede or whatever, just we have a clear answer and it just goes ahead anyway.
There's nothing they
can do.
I think it was like that saying, God willing and the creek don't rise. We will have a president-elect on Wednesday. whoever it may be.
Let's talk about that Wednesday.
We'll find out what happens Wednesday with that. But we got other things that people are voting for tomorrow or perhaps already voted for.
I know. Believe it or not, there are other races that happened.
That are local and pertinent. And probably more directly affect your life day to day. And we've got four ballot questions and some local races.
And so, as Brad mentioned, some people have already voted. And I wanted to point out that Bill Galvin, the Secretary of the Commonwealth, held a press conference this morning where he said that of the 4.5 million registered voters in the state, over 1 million of them have already voted.
Wow.
Which is pretty impressive.
Yeah, 25%. Whoa.
Yeah.
Well, he said that he's expecting the total turnout to be about 3 million, which I think would be pretty amazing. So
that's a pretty good turnout.
Yeah, we're having a couple of reporters are getting the numbers today for our towns to see how the early voter turnout was, and then obviously we will have all the numbers and stuff Tuesday night and Wednesday.
Great.
So ballot questions. So I just want to interject here that so my husband voted early last week and called me up after he was done and said, there's no way question four is going to pass. You have to flip the ballot over and the stoners aren't going to do that. So
interesting. It's on the other side of the ballot.
It is.
Wow. So if you're voting tomorrow, don't forget there's stuff on the other side.
They tell you, though, it's a two-sided ballot. Yeah. I voted already. They say it's a two-sided ballot. You know, they give you the heads up. They try and make sure you don't miss it. At least in my experience, they always do that.
It's rigged. The whole thing is rigged.
So we got four questions. Question four is the big one. It's the marijuana question. But let's talk about the other ones first because we could talk about that one.
Yeah,
for a while.
I think that one there, question one we can run through pretty quickly.
Oh yeah, question one's like
doesn't even affect us.
Yeah, I don't think we've written a story about it, but it's an additional slot parlor
in Revere, right?
It would go in Revere. The ballot question doesn't specify this, but it's really so there are a limited number of slot parlor licenses that are available in the state. In order to get additional, they need to be approved as a referendum by the voters. So there's a developer. He wants to build a casino in Revere. As far as I've heard, it's not really, you know, that beloved of a project.
Especially in Somerville.
Yeah, so there's also another casino right near where he wants to build it. Mm-hmm. So that's another part of this whole controversial issue.
Right.
So, again, it's only going to really be in Revere and affect the greater Boston area, not so much Metro West. But, you know, I think it should really only be them that votes on it. But that's how it works.
Right.
So we're voting on what's going to happen to them. You know, decide what you want with that information, but just not too much else to talk about.
Yeah, and FYI, it's not anything you'd see in Vegas. There's no table games, and there's no more than 1,250 slot machines. So
is there Greyhound racing?
Twin River. I don't know. Maybe.
Did we outlaw Greyhound racing?
We outlawed Greyhound racing.
Okay. Yeah, that's like a good thing that we did.
Four or five years ago? Yeah.
Right. I remember that was a ballot question. Yeah.
So then number two.
The controversial one.
Yeah, number two has been pretty controversial. This is on whether we should lift the cap on charter schools in Massachusetts. Currently, there is a cap. The fighting on both sides has been pretty contentious. Any of the polls that I've seen, both sides is basically neck and neck.
It is. Yeah.
45-45. Yeah.
It would raise the cap. So I think it's 12 additional charter mm-hmm. schools a year, or either new charter schools or increasing the enrollment of existing charter schools. I'm not too sure what the current cap is.
I can look that up, but while I'm looking that up, I will say that so right now, people who support Question 2 say that it gives more resources to especially inner city schools that struggle with having good schools. You know, a lot of times when if you live in Boston or Springfield or Lowell or Worcester, you don't have a lot of say in where your kid goes to school, and you might not be able to afford to buy a house somewhere that has good schools. So the proponents of Question 2 say that this allows more resources to be devoted to these students in kind of underserved school districts.
And part of the law would give priority to districts in the bottom 25% of performance metrics based on standardized testing. So,
and again, this is probably another question where it's not going to have as big an effect here in the Metro West area, where we already have some charter schools set up. There's one in Framingham.
Marlboro.
Yeah, but it's probably going to be more for the cities.
Mm-hmm. And a lot of the schools in Metro West are very good. I mean, that's why a lot of people live here, is because the schools, students here do very well, and the test scores are all very high.
And some districts, like Hudson, already have school choice, so there is that option as well. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure the entire breakdown. Because I cover Hudson School Committee so closely, I know that that's always a topic of discussion for them, is school choice and talking about that. So sometimes that is another route for people who are trying to get out of a school district they're not a fan of or isn't serving their child's needs.
Right. Then, which there are many reasons for that.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
So, but opponents also have very fair things to say about it. A lot of public school districts, understandably, have come out with resolutions opposing this measure. I've seen a lot of progressives on the internet argue that this is sort of a step away from trying to fix problems with public schools and just sidestepping it with an alternate public school format that has a little bit more corporate influence than
and the pro charter school people say is, but we can't afford to wait for that. We need to do this now.
Right. Yeah. So the way that the funding works is that every child in a school district, there's a certain budget number assigned to them, and then if they go to a charter school, or if it's school choice, if they go to a different school district, that money goes with the students.
Yeah, so the sending school pays tuition.
Right, exactly. Yeah. So if, for example, your child is enrolled at a Framingham school and they go to a charter school, Framingham has to pay whatever that amount is to the charter school.
Right.
So the opponents of Question 2 not only are they concerned about that money flowing out, because it can be, for a lot of towns and cities, that number is quite high. Charter schools also don't have unions for their teachers, mm-hmm. which a lot of people are very in favor of. And they also do not have to accept every student that applies. So we're talking mostly, you know, students with special needs, students who have the individualized education plans that by law, their public school must educate them, must accommodate them, or if they can't, then they have to pay for an appropriate school for that child to go to. But charter schools do not have the same requirement. Many of them do, don't get me wrong, you know. Many of them are not saying
that. Is a common, you know, argument against it is, you know, essentially saying that charter schools can discriminate,
right,
in that sense. And I teachers unions, school committees, public school committees,
most of them across the state are very against it,
extremely against it. Almost, you know, every school to my knowledge in our area has, you know, every school committee, I think, has, you know, signed some sort of letter of opposition just saying they're against it.
And I want to interject here that I looked it up, and the state law right now says that no more than 120 charter schools are allowed to operate in the state, and there are currently 78 active charter schools.
Oh,
right.
Okay. So.
Okay.
I think the other...
Are caps within the cap?
Yes.
Yeah.
No, I mean, I think that they're allowed to have up to 120, but it's just that it's hard to open them, so... But that's...
I don't think we should get... We don't need to get that wonky about it.
Yeah, but mind you, also, covers schools, enrollment increasement. Right.
But I was going to say also charter schools, unlike public schools, like they can close. So that's I think that's another thing that opponents are concerned about, that if a charter school is not working out or whatever happened, they don't get enough funding, they can close. And then that's students without a school.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So
that is for sure the most contentious debate. It's where the most money has been spent in terms of campaign ads and such.
There's
and
been a lot of out-of-state funding for both sides.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of big names behind.
There's some millions of dollars. I think there's like over $25 million in this mm-hmm. ballot question right now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we'll have to see how that goes.
Right.
So question three.
No money has been spent on question three. If you look in comparison, I think it might be like $1 million.
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm just throwing out a number. But question three is actually kind of interesting. It's a regulation that would stipulate that farms who have livestock have to keep said livestock in a cage where that they can stand up, lie down, turn around, and extend their limbs fully. Which leads me to believe, why would you keep an animal in a cage where they can't do that?
But
if you're just going to eat them, then what's the point?
But I mean, that if you, and I'm not saying that I agree with this position, but if you can maximize the space of, or I'm sorry, maximize the number of livestock that you're keeping, then yeah, you can cram them into cage. Also, that's kind of how veal is made. Which is terrible.
And yeah. But it's a...
I don't eat it.
But. You know, we get in... The problem with this question is you start getting into the whole moral argument of animal treatment. And then, you know, so you can say, well, they're just animals. You're going to eat them anyway. And then there's other people say, well, they're living creatures. They have feelings. They, you know, they have emotions. Mm-hmm. And if you're going to kill them, you should at least do it humanely. You know, so there's that argument. That's not really what's coming into this ballot question, though, is that this whole argument right here has not really reared its head, as far as I can tell. It's been much more about economics, at least on the opposition.
Right.
They're saying this will raise food prices and put farmers out of business, but there's only one farmer in the state that currently does this practice. So it's sort of just a bookkeeping, and there'll be plenty of implementation time for that farmer to change over. It doesn't happen overnight.
It actually wouldn't go into effect until 2022.
Oh, that long?
Yeah.
So plenty of time to
also, I think Rick Holmes, our opinions editor, was telling me last week that they have something similar in California, and that the price of eggs went up by maybe a dime per dozen. So wasn't
right. Yeah, because that's the easiest way to posit that argument is animal rights versus too heavy-handed regulations on farmers.
Right.
Yeah.
Which I mean is a fair. You know, that's a fair point. If eggs are going to double in price, that's that right now is a cheap source of protein for people.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So.
And that would have a trickling effect across the economy.
Yeah.
Yeah, but.
And my budget, I love eggs. I'm really torn between my love for animal meat and my love for animals.
It's a hard one. I love animals.
Yeah. I was a vegetarian for 3 years, and.
What broke you?
Bacon.
Really? Everyone always says bacon, and like that's not the thing that gets me. Like the thing that gets me is the most like morally indefensible stuff, like veal. Like I love veal.
Well,
it's just so.
I don't eat veal. I still don't eat veal.
I love it, but it's so hard to justify. You can't. You really can't.
Yeah,
it's horrible.
I don't eat veal. I don't like it, so it's easy for me to not eat it. But bacon is really.
See,
sick.
Like I like bacon. I will eat bacon for sure. But I can very easily, like, if I had to give up bacon for the rest of my life, I could do it like that. No problem. That's fine.
You know
fine.
Who I think should be in a cage where they can't move around?
Whoa, wasps?
This wasp in here.
Oh, too bad man. We don't have a newspaper.
I hope the mics pick up the sound of the wasp.
Yeah. So otherwise, we just seem a little insane right now.
Yeah.
Talking about a wasp.
All right, so
no
let's go to the,
keep moving.
The last ballot
Speaking
question.
Of paranoia.
Right. Question four. Marijuana.
Take it away, Brad.
You gotta legalize it.
All right, marijuana.
Brad's our Q4.
That's not an endorsement.
Reporter,
I was just quoting something
at this point, and he's gonna be at.
I'm gonna be at the party tomorrow night for the Yes on 4 folks.
Can I just
over
say that
Boston?
When I heard you're going to this party, I really thought it was gonna be. You ever see those funny things? It's like in the 20s during Prohibition, and then they would like I think it was on Star Trek once or something when they were on the holodeck, but they have like. You know, it's the bar and everyone's like playing cards and they look all polite when the cops are in and they leave and then they just like turn a crank and then it's all the liquor and stuff. So it just made me think that I know this is not going to happen, but it entertained me to think that we hear it passes and then they just kind of like crank something and all these joints just spill out and everyone's like,
someone's going to very slowly slide a bong out right. of their backpack.
Yeah.
Which is not going
to
happen.
Open up the door to the bathroom and just...
Right. It's not going to be instantly legal.
No, so. December 15th it goes into effect. That is when, if question four passes, you can legally smoke weed on December 15th.
And you can legally grow up to 12 plants in your home.
Indeed.
Yeah, so that's sort of
what we're talking about. Or it's 6 per person, 12 per household.
Okay.
So, all right, let's run down the ballot question. So what we have here is what it's being called is the campaign to regulate and tax marijuana, like alcohol. And it will legalize it, as Peter Tosh once asked us to do. And it will essentially, it will open up the door for anyone 21 and older to legally possess up to a certain amount of marijuana.
If it was 10 ounces, you can have 10 ounces.
Mm-hmm. For the recreational use. Sale, of course, would be highly regulated. And in dispensaries, there will be the creation of a cannabis control commission with the state's treasurer office.
And there'll be like super tax. It'll be taxed at the sales rate. And then there's like a special tax for it. And then towns can also throw in another tax.
There will also be a 15-member marijuana advisory board created for the state to sort of oversee things like advertising, and the Cannabis Control Commission will also have a big part in this. So sort of what we have here from the proponents is saying, look, you know, the times are moving forward. Marijuana has not been proven to be, as they say in their arguments, is that it has not been proven to be dangerous, or at least not as nowhere near as dangerous as alcohol. There should be a freedom to smoke it for an adult to have that right. And if you tax and regulate it, you cut off the black market. You get rid of those drug dealers.
Reduce crime.
Yeah. Reduce arrests. Reduce strain on police. What opponents say is that this is reckless because we're modeling it off of Colorado's law. And they say that, look, Colorado has just implemented this and they saw a big spike in drug driving. They saw, you know...
Drug driving,
yeah. People smoking and then driving. You know, the law has not had enough time to sort of settle in Colorado. We have not seen the long-term effects. We should, you know, let them be the guinea pig. They chose that, but we need to slow down because, you know, there's the edibles. The edibles are very strong. People have wanted to hospitalize because they are too strong and they become incapacitated. There's fears that they could get into the hands of children because they look like regular candies if someone is careless and leaves them out, where a child could easily grab them. They are concerned about that the tax revenues really is not going to be that much, that we're not actually getting as much as the proponents are saying we're going to be getting from this. And they're worried it could exacerbate the opioid crisis, that we're, at the very least, you know, they're not saying that it's a gateway drug, but they are saying that we're in the middle of this combating heroin, and we want to just introduce another legal substance and start having to deal with drivers on the road who are stoned, who, you know, introducing people to, you know, drugs who might not have been introduced to them before. So there's a lot of real concerns there. And the problem that I've encountered covering this and going to the debate that they had that I know we sponsored it over at Regis College. The problem is the pro side has one study that says one thing, and then the anti side has another study that says the exact opposite. And it keeps going back and forth, and they keep citing studies that just contradict each other. And it's like, well, which one do you trust?
And people are using the studies to confirm the opinion that they had before they read the study.
Yeah.
In a lot of cases. There's a lot of information, and it's really tough to sort through. I've run into a couple times myself covering
And can we
forums.
Talk about the money that has been poured into this? I don't think think it's quite at the same level as the question two spending, but what really surprised me was last week that the Catholic Church dumped $850,000 into
this.
So
it's very weird.
They're against it. I mean, they're very against it, which, you know, I guess doesn't surprise me, but it did surprise me that they put so much into it. Although I'm reading this Boston Globe story now, and it said that the all together, though, that the anti-marijuana campaign for a safe and healthy Massachusetts, still it's less than half of what it's been raised by
Question 4 people. So, and a lot of that money came in at the last minute.
Yeah.
Sheldon Adelson, donated $1 million just a few weeks ago to the No campaign, but this is very last minute. This is in October that this happened. And then the Catholic Church came in with money.
Right.
Now, this is a lot of money, but it's right at the end of the game, whereas the Yes campaign had gotten their money ahead of time.
Right.
And they bought up ad space all throughout October. Like, they prepared, like, okay, we're going to start really launching the campaign in the middle of October.
Yeah, and they were really organized. I remember when they first – it was about a year ago when everyone had to start – turning in their ballot questions so they could be approved by the Attorney General. They had like five just to make sure that one of them would all, you know, slightly different language just to make sure that at least one of them would get in there.
So the funding for them came from the estate of the founder or one of the CEOs of Progressive Insurance. Oddly, he died, but he wanted to leave his estate to really trying to legalize marijuana. That's a weird situation. Yeah. Now the opponents say that this is an industry bill. It's going to benefit a marijuana industry, you know, dealers of death, et cetera, that the Marijuana Advisory Board, 15-member board, 9 members have to be from the marijuana industry. You know, proponents obviously say, well, you want experts to be on this. And then opponents say, well, you're just stacking the deck to favor the industry. So there's that question as well in this. Is this a corporate, you know, campaign or not? The Yes campaign says it's not corporate. It's, you know, yes, you'll create a $1 billion industry in the state, but it's not just handing over the keys to the car to them, whereas the opponents kind of make it sound like, yes, you are handing over the keys to the car.
Right.
So it's very strange there as well. The money in this campaign has been very weird and who's for and against it. It's just strange.
I know, like Rick Steves, the travel guy?
Yeah.
Is really in favor of it. He has done a bunch of events. I kept getting press releases for it and reading them. Like, wait, the guy that does all those books on, you know, doing Europe on the cheap? Yes, he is a really big marijuana proponent. I thought maybe he was from here. He's not. I think he lives out in Colorado.
This might be a good seeing in the saying that since this is going to come out on Monday afternoon, if you're in Boston area tonight, doors open at 6 p.m., Faneuil Hall, Bill Weld, whose running mate had a heart attack on stage because of marijuana the other day. You see that?
No.
So Gary Johnson, Libertarian nominee for president, was in the middle of a debate of some sort or a forum. I'm not sure who it was with, but one of the people he was speaking with said that marijuana can increase your risk of heart attacks with up to an hour after smoking. And the woman was talking, and then Gary Johnson just grabs his chest and makes a and just falls on the floor. So so I know that he and Bill Weld are both big proponents of legalizing marijuana. So if you want to go see Bill Weld and hang out with a bunch of libertarians tonight at Faneuil Hall, 7 o'clock, Melissa Joan Hart is a featured speaker.
Cliff
Calarsa
and Sabrina the Teenage Witch.
Yeah, so I'm going to try and get out a little early today, see if I can go to that, because that sounds hilarious, honestly, in my opinion.
I was in Seattle a couple of weeks ago, and I went to a legal marijuana store named Herbin Legends.
Ooh.
And I'm
looking forward to the puns, let me say.
A kid can't get anywhere near this place. It's like going into a nightclub or something. I walked into a room where there were just two large men who were checking IDs, and then they would let you enter the store after going through that whole thing. And then you're in the store, and then it's kind of a surreal experience. But
there's one thing to talk about, and that's the advertising here. The No One For campaign has started rolling out advertisements and very strong advertisements, but you know they're a little controversial. For example, they have one where it's a mother and daughter walking by a marijuana dispensary, and it's kind of this big flashing like, you know, pot leaf in the window and this whole flashy thing. And then they see the son walk out and it's like, oh, awkward. And so that's sort of saying like this, do you want this on Main Street? And the problem is that will never happen because the law essentially will require that these buildings be nondescript as possible.
They're going to be
you're not going to
like we work in the blandest.
You're not going to have neon signs.
They're going to be here. It's going to look like
they're not going to look like liquor stores. They're not going to have, you know, Budweiser logos in the window. It's going to be very discreet by law.
Right.
And that's another thing with like packaging of the edibles is that they're going to have to be discreet by law. Initially, Colorado didn't have that. They had all these knockoff bags, like, you know, it would be like reefer puffs or whatever that, you know, look like Reese's Pieces. And
Tarts.
Yeah, exactly. And they would be knockoff products.
But the ones here would have to be like clear or like
they,
a paper bag.
Colorado did away with that. They realized this is terrible because kids mistake it for the real thing. So now it has to be these sort of vague, opaque packages that, you know, so you're not confusing them. That's another thing there. So in that ad from the No on 4 campaign, that's not accurate. That's, you know, that's sort of a misrepresentation.
Well, I think we should leave it there. Just as a reminder that polls on Tuesday are open from 7 a.m. to 8 p.m. So make sure that if you haven't already voted, that you go vote. So, Brad, you had a story this past Sunday about the contested races that we have locally. So why don't you I think we all grabbed a copy of the paper just to review. So why don't we quickly go over what our local races are?
Sure. So we have a number of local races. We have several incumbents that are running for re-election with challengers. Every state senator and state representative is up for re-election. Most of them are unopposed. But locally, we do have a few contested races. State Senator Jamie Eldridge is facing a Republican challenger and a Green Party challenger. Senator Jason Lewis is up against a Republican challenger. Senator Richard Ross is up against a Democrat from Wayland. And we have Michael Moore from Millbury. He kind of covers the Worcester-Shrewsbury area, and he's got a Republican challenger. For state representatives, one of the big races with an incumbent is Danielle Gregoire, is running against the Marlboro Republican City Committee Chairman, Paul Farrow. And in the 12th Worcester District, we have Harold Nodden Jr. From Clinton, who's running against Charlene D. Calogero. But those races, incumbents, most of the time are safe. I can't say it for sure. There could be a big upsurge in some of these races, and, you know, you could see them. But for the most part, it goes to the incumbents. It's hard for a challenger to unseat somebody. But we do have two open seats, and those are the big races here, because an open seat really can be anybody's game.
And it's kind of rare for these seats to open up, because a lot of our state legislators, you know, for good or for bad, are there for a long time. And like you said, it's very easy for them to get reelected, especially if they're especially if they're Democrats. I mean, some of the districts in our coverage area for Metro West and for Milford are pretty solidly Republican, like Richard Ross's district in Norfolk, Bristol, Middlesex district. Richard Ross is a Republican.
Yeah. One of the few real Republican strongholds in the state.
And he has been there quite a while, and, you know, he keeps getting reelected.
Ryan Fatman is up for reelection. No one's running against him, right? And he's a Republican. Very far-right Republican for Massachusetts.
What's interesting is that the Milford area has we're looking at that wasp again.
Oh, yeah, there's a wasp in here, so if you hear screaming.
Yeah, if this podcast ends with screaming, it means that we've found the wasp nest, and we're truly doomed. But what I was saying was that in the Milford area has... And it'd be cool to see, like, a heat map of this, like, 1990, 2000, 2010, because it's really turning Republican out there. I think that the Milford seat, what is it?
Okay, so Rep. John Fernandez is leaving, and we have Milford Selectman Brian Murray versus Hopedale former Selectwoman Sandra Biagetti.
Yeah.
So you...
Biagetti's the Republican.
She's a Republican.
Murray's the Democrat.
Murray's Democrat. You know probably more about them because you used to cover Milford, so why don't you talk a little bit about that race?
Sure, yeah. So it's interesting in that the area has been turning red for quite some time, and that seat held by John Fernandez, I think it's the 10th Worcester District?
Yep, 10th Worcester.
I'm not sure, but it covers Milford, Hopedale, Mendon, and a little bit of Medway.
Precinct 1.
Yeah, Medway. Like a tiny little bit of Medway. It's
And Fernandez is a Democrat.
Fernandez is a Democrat. He's been there for 10 years. And him and Brian Murray are, they've been working together for a long time in Milford Public Service. And Murray feels very much like the natural succession of a Democrat to take the seat. He's been a selectman for 15 years. He's totally entrenched. He knows the area. He
school
knows,
committee before that.
Yeah.
Plus Milford, it must be. I mean, yeah. Mendon, Hopedale, and a little bit of Medway. Milford is like the biggest
Milford's
part of that
huge.
District.
Yeah, yeah, it's basically Milford in terms of population.
But so he's got name recognition in his favor.
Yeah, name recognition. He just won a really tough race for selectman in the spring, where his opponent spent near $20,000 to try to unseat him, and it didn't work out for him. Sandra Biagetti is a select woman in Hopedale. She is an interesting challenger in that she very much has the same kind of appeal, I think, to people in the area that Ryan Fatman did. No one expected Ryan Fatman to win. I covered that race, and no one expected him to win before he did win. He unseated Richard Moore, who a long time, like longer than Fernandez, probably... I think 15 years.
Yeah,
very, very long time legislator. So I will see. That area is in flux in terms of which party controls it. I think more so than the Middlesex county races.
Do you have a sense of why that is?
Yeah, immigration dominates almost every political discussion in Milford.
Right. They have a large Ecuadorian population, right?
A large Ecuadorian population, a large Brazilian population. There is a feeling among some longtime Milford residents that immigration is out of control and that illegal immigration, there needs to be reform in that. The Matt Denise incident 5 years ago was really sort of
that was kind of a
defining
point.
Moment.
Yeah,
of
and
that.
If you're not familiar with that case, Matthew Denise was hit and killed by Nicholas Guaman, who was an illegal immigrant from Ecuador, who was drunk driving, and the trial took a really long time to get off the ground, and because Nicholas Guaman speaks a very rare...
It's called Quechua.
Yeah, Quechua, a very rare dialect of
Spanish
in
yeah.
Ecuador, so it was hard to get... Anyway, it was a long and complicated case, and it really became kind of a high watermark for... immigration politics in that area. Do you think that, have you seen anything about Biagetti being an outward Trump supporter? Has she said anything?
She, when I talked to her, she basically didn't outright say it. And I can't put words into her mouth in any sense, but, you know, I do know she said she absolutely can't vote for Clinton.
Right.
Is sort of what she said. So I don't know what she feels about Trump. I do know that she comes down very hard on immigration. It's very much kind of one of the cornerstones of her platform, and she's very hard, and she's trying to show that Murray is not as strong in immigration. Which what's interesting about Murray is that for a Democrat, he's also pretty hard on immigration compared to the party line. You know, I asked him about licenses for illegal immigrants, and he said absolutely not. You know, He definitely, you know, kind of falls in line with that Milford sentiment, you know, of those concerns for immigration. I think Biagetti does come down harder. She, you know, she's very concerned about the EBT card system and kind of reforming that. She feels that there's a lot of costs that are incurred by illegal immigrants that she wants to focus on, particularly in the courts. You know, she talked about that translation issue, and she said she didn't, you know, like how that played out. She thought that wasn't fair. And yeah, Bill.
I know that Fatman built his campaign around EBT card reform, and it worked out very well for him. And she's sort of following that same path. So this is going to be among the more interesting races to watch.
Absolutely.
I think that. It's a little bit more interesting, though. The race in Ashland is interesting in its own right.
Yeah, do you want to talk about that? Because the 7th Middlesex. Ashland, you've covered that a bit. What is it? It's Ashland and then...
Yeah. It's Ashland and South Framingham, six
right.
precincts in South Framingham.
Yeah, so it's precincts, I believe.
126.
Right here, 8, 13, yeah. 14, 16, 17, and 18. Right.
Yes.
Brad, do you want to handle that one?
Yeah, we have here, Democrat Jack Patrick Lewis versus Republican Yolanda Greaves. So Lewis lives in Framingham. He is in Precinct 8, and he is the founder and executive director of Out Metro West, a nonprofit organization for LGBT youth, and it's sort of like after-school youth groups, support groups, just parties, general, all-around sort of youth program. And
he's also pretty young. He's only 32.
He's only 32. I honestly thought he was older. I thought he was probably pushing mid to late 30s. But when he said he was 32, that took me aback.
Doesn't that technically place him as a millennial?
He is a millennial, and he's proud to be a millennial candidate. He likes to cite that there's 16 millennials currently the nominees for their parties for state seats right now.
Yeah.
And he's very proud to be a part of that.
Oh, that'd be an interesting post-election story.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's funny because by some calculations, I too am a millennial, but I'm not. It's really.
It doesn't feel like.
It doesn't feel like it. I've heard people like me who were born between like 1975 and 1983 called the Oregon Trail generation, which I really prefer. So.
Yeah.
I like that.
So he is up against Yolanda Greaves, or is it Graves? She is Graves. A Ashland selectman, and. She actually was independent, unenrolled, until running for this race, where she decided to run as a Republican. She refers to herself as a Charlie Baker Republican. She's very firmly against Trump, does not stand for Trump at all.
Yeah, in an editorial board interview with her, she said that she doesn't have a candidate in the presidential race, which
Charlie Baker has pretty much said the same thing, too.
Yeah. That was a good way to answer the question.
She's, she's very in line. She's she has a lot of school committee influence. She talks about how she took over Karen Spilka's seat there. Both candidates, have experience working, with Spilka. Spilka's been campaigning very hard for Jack Lewis, but, Greaves has worked with her in the past and on Ashland programs. As a select woman, she, has handled, working with the legislator a lot. They're taking over. They're going for Tom Santacandro's seat. Tom Santacandro has held that seat for, I believe, 12 years now, and he has decided to leave. So this is who we're going for. It's a very strong Democratic stronghold, but Greaves, being from Ashland, does have that going for her, where it's all of Ashland and only part of Framingham.
Right.
So there is that advantage that she's very well known in town, and she's been on the board for many years. As far as policy goes. Jack Lewis is very much in favor of a progressive platform. He's in favor of the millionaire's tax. He kind of talks about how he, wants to make sure that we're not, putting burden on middle class, on veterans, on the elderly, on people who are most in need. Greaves talks a lot about fiscal responsibility. She's, as far as education goes, she's in favor of lifting the charter school cap, but she's also in favor of reforming charter funding, no matter what happens with that ballot question, which we'll talk about in just a minute. So we sort of have, a fairly moderate down the middle Republican and a fairly progressive Democrat. He's not extreme by any sense, but he's very strong on the progressive platform as far as running along, and he's got a lot of support from all the other Democrats in the area.
That's true. I think what makes that race interesting is that Greaves is on paper looks like the natural successor to that position, given that she's had a lot of municipal experience, and that these are the kind of people that you pluck for a state representative seat. School committee, selectman, state representative is a very natural arc for a politician. Lewis, on the other hand, comes from being a minister and the founder of a nonprofit, and he unseated the Democrat, Phil Jack, that had that natural succession.
Yeah.
Oh, Phil Jack, the primary, right?
In the primary. It was a three-way primary race between Phil Jack, Brett Walker, and Jack Lewis. And so Jack kind of surprised everybody by coming out on top.
Yeah, that was a surprise. And I think that it'd be very interesting to see. Whichever way that this particular race goes, it's going to be interesting. It's either going to flop to a Republican or to the progressive branch of the Democratic Party, which both of those you could technically say are minorities in the Massachusetts House. So, we'll see. We'll see tomorrow.
Okay, so now it's time for our Around the Carrig segment, where we chit-chat about stuff that you might want to chit-chat with your coworkers or friends as you enjoy a nice warm beverage. So mine today is this this video that I saw on Twitter yesterday. I retweeted it, if you follow me, at Megan B. Kelly. I don't know if you guys remember the, was it like Billy Bass or something, that you would press the button and it would sing?
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Remember that? So someone has hooked up their Alexa, which is that Amazon device that you can say, you know, Alexa, what's the weather going to be today? And then it'll say it back to you. They hooked it up to their Billy Bass fish. And so it says like what the weather is, but the fish's mouth is moving the whole time. And I will link to this on the show notes for this, because it really has to be seen in order to be believed. But I'll show it to you guys right now. And then, cause it's like,
Alexa.
I feel like, hold on, stop. The thing that I really like about this the most is that people really love Alexa, or like the mm-hmm. Google Home thing, Siri. It's great. But something about putting it with the mouth of this fish and the mouth is moving is just really, it really gets into the creepy, like almost not quite the uncanny valley. It's a little strange. So here, let me play this for you guys.
So you know how that whole DDoS attack against Dyne that took down Twitter and Reddit,
yes,
temporarily was powered by the Internet of Things, all the internet connected devices like security cameras and DVRs? Now, are these Billy Bass fish connected to the internet? Imagine a wave of singing fish taking down the internet infrastructure.
Brad,
hacked fish.
It is a nightmare to think of and to behold. All right, so what is your hopefully non-dystopian...
mine is wonderful. It's Filmstruck. It is a new streaming service powered by the Criterion Collection and Turner Classic Movies, and it's a film buff's dream. It's got probably 1,000 movies just on launch, and it's essentially just all sorts of classic films, top-notch movies, stream in HD, foreign films, art house classics, you know... They really knocked themselves out with it. So, you know, if you're a big Criterion Collection person, I signed up for this day one. It launched on November 1st after being pushed back a few weeks. And I go home and I just watch movies right now because it's so much fun. So, you know, I'm trying to think of filmmakers who they've, like almost the entire filmography of Akira Kurosawa is up there. Fellini and Bergman, if you're into the whole European art house scene, but they also got classic Hollywood, famous actors. It's really top notch streaming, and I have no more reason to have like Hulu. So, you know, I can just get rid of that, and I just use my family's Netflix account. So it's really the only thing I need.
Will you log in with your Netflix account?
No, you don't log in with your Netflix account. My family, Netflix.
Oh, never mind. Sorry.
So I don't pay for Netflix.
You were just talking about your whole streaming library.
So I can just pay for Filmstruck, which is pretty affordable, and that's it. You know, that's all I really need right now for my purposes, because anything else I can just, you know, watch on other realms of the internet.
Speaking of that, my mom's Netflix, there was some trouble with the credit card thing, and I really wanted to watch Narcos one night. So instead of calling my mom to tell her that she has a credit card problem with her account and I can't watch it,
I
was an adult.
I was going to say, you should
and
be an adult.
I purchased my own Netflix account for the first time in my life. I'm now paying $8 a month for my own streaming.
Congratulations.
And wow, I really... What is that word that people use? Adulting?
Oh, no, don't you start with that. I will kick you out of this room.
That's me. The adulterer.
The adulterer?
Yikes. Well, anyway, I didn't want to out another thing about myself, but the remastered edition...
You're having an affair.
The remastered edition of Skyrim came out about a week and a half ago, and it's all I can talk about because it's all I've been doing with my free time. This is such a wonderful, immersive game for a nerd like me.
What is Skyrim?
Skyrim is a large map fantasy game in which you can pick a character and a race and a style of combat and life in a large, immersive, multiracial, multicultural fantasy world.
Is this one of those
No, it's
single one that you player. Play. Like, is it like World of Warcraft?
No, or it's not an MMORPG. It's a single player
RPG. On your local system.
You pick a character, and then you basically role play with this character through a series of quests and adventures, and your to do list in Skyrim becomes bigger than your to do list in real life, and you play for 5 to 6 hours at a time sometimes, and then you kind of dissociate from reality, which
what was
depending
that you were
on the
saying
day,
about game 15 again?
It's nice. It's really nice, and there's a bunch of mods for it, which are developer. Like fan developers can make things for the game, and then you can download them and install them on your thing and play them. And I downloaded a mod the other night where you can summon all of the children characters in the game at once. So the spell is called Summon 42 Children.
What?
So you walk into a dungeon and you summon 42 children, and they're all armed with like very nice weapons. And they all summon their own little monsters, and they all just go and attack whoever there is to attack, and it's hilarious.
I have to say that I know people deride playing video games, whatever, marathons. Like, I'm in awe of people who can actually focus on something for that long, because I cannot.
Oh,
I get bored after. I mean, depending on what the task is, I get bored after. It could be anywhere from 5 minutes to an hour. So.
There have been times where I stop playing Skyrim, and then I go back to this so-called real life, and I get sad. That
I always know
so,
it's bad.
It's so inferior
when I start dreaming about the video game.
Oh, I've had dreams in video games before.
Like you're playing you're dreaming that you are playing the video game, not like you're in the video game world. Just that you are playing the video game in your dream.
No, oh, I thought no. I've had dreams from the perspective of my character.
No, just from the perspective of me sitting there in front of a computer.
No. I've dreamt in the universe of the video games that I play before.
Sleeping is probably the only thing I can handle to do more than say 4 hours at a time. I'm really in awe of that. So
I try and limit my video game intake just because I get addicted like that. So I try not to play too many games, but yeah, I have my weak ones that I can't stop once I start.
Skyrim is my weak one, number one.
Yeah.
When I was a young lass of seven, I bought a Nintendo with my first communion money, and my dad would stay up really late playing Legend of Zelda, and one day I accidentally erased his game, and I started freaking out and panicked, and I ran next door to the little boy who also could play really well. I was like, Dan, I erased my dad's game. You have to get it back. So I made him sit down and play until I knew where my dad had stopped. So my dad would literally, my mom worked some night shifts, and I would get up at like a kid does, thirsty, whatever. I'm like, where? No one's in their bedroom. And I'd go all the way down to the basement and be like, Daddy? I'm playing Zelda. So then after that, I got my friend to restore his game and everything. But then after that, my dad was like, you all are not allowed to bring in video game consoles into this house because I can't control myself.
I spent like $120 on like an impulse buy to get a Nintendo 3DS because I really wanted to play Pokemon. So I wanted to play one of the new games. So I just went out one night after work at like 10 p.m. to the only store that was video game store was open over at Natick Mall, Game Underground, and I just like, give me a 3DS used and like whatever Pokemon game you have.
when the Wii first came out, gosh, what was that, like 2005?
4 or 5, I would say.
So my husband was so, we were not married then, he was so excited about getting one that we got up at like 4 a.m. and sat outside of Costco in Dedham until they opened the doors. And we were like the second people in line, and there was probably like 200 people in line for a Wii. We had to get a number and everything. They had like a special game pack. And I can't even, I don't have the energy for that now, but I don't really see people waiting in line like that anymore. It's like you can pre-order everything online now, so.
Yeah.
That's why
you can just download straight to the console for Xbox.
Getting the console itself, though. Oh. We had to wait in line to get the console.
I don't know.
All right. Well, that sounds good, and we will we'll be back on Wednesday for some post election. We'll be sweeping the rabble of democracy and discussing what happened the night before. I'm sure we'll all be just hung over from the electoral strain.
Indeed.
It's
indeed.
Rigged. I think it's rigged.
Hey, we already know the answers. We're the press.
Right.
Yeah, that's true.
We're the lamestream media. Thanks for listening. This podcast was produced by Megan Kelly, Bill Shaner, and Brad Avery, and it was edited by Bill Shaner. You can find more episodes of the podcast in iTunes or Stitcher, and you can also visit MetroWestDailyNews.com/podcast to get all the episodes plus show notes about each episode. Thanks for listening. Don't forget to vote.
You can't take a breath or yet another step back. Whoever drew the lines for how this thing goes couldn't have understood that somebody's there running cold. It's going home. And I won't explain what you're unable to read between. Don't know where I've been. Been walking the streets in my father's clothes, and now I'm stuck. I don't like going home no more. The only safe face you found.